Welcome to Remarkable Retail Podcast, Season 4, Episode 7. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Steve Dennis.
Why does it take a crisis for retailers to innovate? Steve, welcome back. We're back on the mic for another solo episode. Thanks again to all the listeners. These episodes, and we've got lots of interviews coming up, but these back-to-back solo episodes, these are kind of fundamental, interestingly provocative strategy points. So, and it's resonating well with the listeners. So we're going to talk about, it's actually part of your book.
Yeah, it's been kind of an interest of mine probably for 20 plus years, having worked in innovation and often running into or being part of organizations when I was in senior roles, but also last bit here as a consultant, seeing why is it that retailers often struggle to make the changes they need to make.
All right. Well, we've got our news coming up. But before that, speaking of innovation, we got some innovation. We have a new feature, a new segment that we want to tell listeners about. Ask Steve. What is this? You can ask Steve a question, and we will pick the most remarkable questions and answer them. And I've set up with a organization or a link called SpeakPipe, where you can leave a voicemail for us online. We'll get it. And you got 90 seconds to give us ask us a question. And we'll pick one, and we'll pick remarkable ones, and we'll put it into the podcast, and we'll hear the Vox Populi, voice of the people.
Ooh, that's Latin, isn't it?
That is Latin. That is Latin. All right. So if you want to participate, we'll put this in the show notes, but it is at SpeakPipe, S-P-E-A-K pipe, speakpipe.com/remarkableretail. So speakpipe.com/remarkableretail. You have 90 seconds to leave a provocative or interesting question, and we'll take it on. All right. Let's get to the news. Now, it happens to be a big earnings week, but behind the earnings, because we're not really a, you know, current events podcast, lots of great people do that, we are more talking about what the earnings mean. So let's talk about Macy's. So Macy's came out with a couple of interesting statements this earnings bundled together, one of which was about e-commerce. But talk about what you saw in the Macy's earnings.
You know, they were quite strong on a absolute and a relative basis. They had strong sales growth, and like we talked about Walmart, I guess last week, a huge reversal in fortunes when it came to earnings. So swinging from a very sizable loss to a pretty solid profit. Really, the discussion that I saw was, does this mean that like Macy's is back? That this is really an indication of strength and perhaps renewed interest in mall-based department stores. And I think that's the wrong conclusion. I think they're comparing certainly to very weak numbers. As we've talked about a few times, the consumer continues to spend at above normal rates, and that's not going to last forever. And I don't fundamentally see, while I think Macy's is arguably executing, not arguably, I would say they are executing better than JCPenney and some others, but as I often say, better is not the same as good, and it often is far short of remarkable. So I really don't think the fundamental challenges of the moderate department stores have gone away. There's a lot more that has to happen over the long term for Macy's to really be a long-term player.
Now, so we've talked about these organizations that are spinning off their e-commerce and putting them into separate divisions, and you know, there's pros and cons. Feels like more cons, but Macy's was being chased to do that, and they seem to have reached a decision.
Yeah, they said they are rejecting that. They're not going to pursue that as a strategy, and I think that is absolutely the right call. So we'll give props to them on that front, and I think that will help give them you know, the right structure to move ahead.
Well, I was thinking about the old saying, birds of a feather, Allbirds and Wayfair both released earnings, and neither of them were great. What do you think? What's going on?
Well, we've been, not that we're in the predictions business here so much, though I did include some references to this in my predictions for 2022 about the profitless prosperity. In other words, this great sales growth we're seeing from some of these high-profile brands, but not so much profitability. So Wayfair, which has actually been around quite a long time, I think about 20 years, finally swung to a profit after losing gazillion dollars. I think that's approximation, gazillion dialers over about 15 years.
I rounded up.
Yeah. They swung to a profit for a few quarters during the pandemic, and there was some suggestion that that was a sign that they were on to greater things, but yet they have really hit a wall. Their sales were down 11% year over year. And so for a company that's been growing at 20, 30, 35% for a number of years, that was a big step back. And they lost $202 million for the fourth quarter. So despite all the interest and distorted spending in home furnishings, despite this move to online, they don't seem to be benefiting from that. And I think some of it is, you know, they certainly have some issues with supply chain, and, you know, there are other things that aren't awesome for them. But I think what they really did most likely is pull forward a lot of demand they would have had otherwise, and they seem to struggle with moving the top line without spending a ton on marketing and pricing very aggressively. Their gross profit's only like, I don't know if I have that number in front of me, 27% gross margin. You know, that's
doesn't
like
leave
Costco.
A lot of EBITDA at the bottom line, right? Doesn't
exactly. So I think until they can really drive this business without having to spend so much money on marketing and lowering price, it's a shaky business model. And then Allbirds, we talked about. I mean, we had the discussion with Dan McCarthy last year about some of the dynamics of customer value for Allbirds and others. And when they went public 4 or 5 months ago, I predicted that this stock would not continue to be high-flying. See what I did there? Yeah, and their first quarter as a public company came out, and their sales were up pretty strongly, like 27%, I think, for 2020.
Good. That's
good. But their loss was even wider. They lost $45 million for the year. So that is a negative margin of close to 20%. Not so awesome. And the stock is now down 50% since its IPO.
I think I also saw some other news that they were opening in, was it Kohl's? They were opening shop and shops in physical stores. That was their game plan. Did I read that right?
They did announce that they've had a couple of, or maybe just one wholesale partnership with Nordstrom, I believe. I'm not sure how expansive that is. But yes, they are now looking, they're going to look at wider wholesale distribution in addition to continuing to open their own store. So yes, that was a new piece of information in terms of their growth strategy.
It feels like a pretty conventional go-to-market strategy to me. You know, start a brand and then do shop and shops. And boy, we're seeing a lot, right? We're seeing Ulta in Target. We're seeing all kinds of interesting things, but digital native vertical brands being a little less digital and more physical, right?
Well, I think the broader point, probably two broader points. One is that as we've talked about, it's kind of, you know, the foundation of my book is that they're, you know, physical retail isn't dead. There's a lot of reasons why physical retail is an important part of an overall strategy. And I think a lot of these digitally native brands have come to realize that some sort of physical presence is important. I think the partnerships on the wholesale side, you know, that not only gives the digitally native brand more exposure, you know, sort of, even though the margin is shorter, they don't have to spend all this money on customer acquisition because they're leveraging the existing traffic of the retailer. And from the retailer perspective, where it's very difficult, you know, in a world where you can find just about anything online, what's that point of differentiation? What's that reason to shop at, you know, whether it's Kohl's or Macy's, whatever, all these brands, these multi-line department stores or multi-line retailers are trying to find an edge over the Amazons of the world. And so these semi-exclusive wholesale deals can be something that really works for both. So I think it's a very logical strategy, and I suspect we'll continue to see more of it.
All right, let's get on to our episode here. We're talking about, and I share your interest, but not your depth of expertise in this, why it takes a crisis to make change happen. And goodness knows we're faced over the past couple of years with whether it's environmental crisis, whether it's a new war in Europe, or whether it's COVID, that it does seem to motivate behavior. I hate that saying, a good crisis. You know, what is it? Never let a good crisis go to waste, which I hate as a saying, particularly around COVID. But it is the case that we did see a lot of things happen under whether it's duress or whether it was a crisis or whether it was need. And let's talk about it. Let's talk about why this seems to consistently move the business or industries forward.
Yeah, it's really a pattern, and maybe we need to have a psychologist on the show as much as somebody like me, because I do think that it's a pretty persistent pattern, whether we're talking about innovation in the corporate world or in other types of organizations, or whether it's change in our own personal lives, that most people don't make dramatic change until they're in essence forced to, or they've kind of run out of options. You know, it's quite unusual to see people and organizations be proactive. And so I think a lot of what we saw during the COVID era was really born out of desperation, right? I mean, whether it was customers can't come into the store, how do we get inventory out of the store? So we'll do e-commerce fulfillment from stores or curbside pickup, those kinds of things, contactless payment.
Customers don't want to touch us anymore. So how do we do that?
So it was very responsive to that reality. But then there were other things like buy online, pick up in store, which got massively accelerated, or buy online, return to store, that have been around for a really long time. And I think, I don't know the exact numbers, I'm sure somebody can find them, but I want to say that maybe 30-40% of all retailers already had buy online, pick up in store.
Yep.
And then, and then it got to 90%+. And my question would be, well, was there really a good reason that you didn't roll it out pre-COVID? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned this another time on the podcast, but down in Dallas, where I am in Texas, HEB, the big grocery store chain down here, has a upscale supermarket called Central Market. Several years ago, so before COVID, they retrofitted, I believe, all of their stores to create a whole dedicated curbside pickup area where they segregated. They don't have people going up and down the aisle picking to order, so the consumer doesn't have to dodge the pickup people, but they created all this special signage and parking spaces and everything. And it really, really is a slick operation. And, they were in beautiful shape for COVID. Whereas everybody else, the Krogers and Albertsons and everybody, were scrambling to try to figure this out and ultimately don't have a very good setup for it. Yeah, so I don't, in Central Market's case, I don't know the whole story there, whether it was just some customer insight they had, whether it was something about their business.
Is it philosophy? I mean, I've talked to retailers who look at Opus as an expensive way to do retail rather than a strategic advantage and something that customers want. I mean, I think there's a philosophical, we're talking about one specific thing, but I think it has broader implications about let's not do it until we have to kind of thinking, right?
Well, I certainly think there's sort of this automatic pushback that comes from something that is costly, complex, et cetera. You don't want to necessarily automatically sign up for that unless there's a very clear competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming in Central Market's case and in other retailers that have kind of keep pushing the edges on innovation, that they believe that it's to their advantage to get out in front of things and make that inherent. So I think you can certainly look at a lot of retail businesses where, I sometimes call it the defenders of the status quo or the department or no, I think Sucharita Kodali calls it, but where the organization is fundamentally wired to say no, and they relentlessly defend the status quo, and it's only under duress that they're likely to change. And, of course, perhaps the obvious implication of that is you're always playing catch up. And in many cases, particularly the pace at which things move today, you can get so far behind that it's impossible to catch up. Back in the good old days when most things were not digital, it wasn't so easy to scale things.
But is there room in your thinking for let's call it a fast follower strategy? We know that being too far out front, whether it's an edge case or wherever, means leaves you liable to spending a lot of money and maybe going in the wrong direction too fast, then maybe you take a pause. How do you figure that the right cadence, in other words, right? Let's let the competitors take this on and who knows, maybe even create the market. I mean, if customers decide they like it, okay, then we'll do it, right? Is there room, in your thinking for that kind of approach?
Yeah, and I think there's no one size fits all for this. I do think a starting point has a lot to do with the essence of your brand and the story of your brand and why customers are enrolled in your brand. And if your brand is more towards innovation and being the latest and greatest, and you identify with that brand because the brand is at the forefront of fashion or technology or whatever it might be, then you're going to prioritize that differently than a more kind of mundane price-oriented brand, right? So I think the brand strategy and the positioning and being aligned with your customers' values is a starting point. But then you have to go down into the nuts and bolts of it. The second thing I was going to say is my biggest assessment of why it takes a crisis for most retailers to innovate is they fundamentally misunderstand risk. Hmm. In other words,
What do you mean?
Yeah, they think that a slow and steady approach or a wait and see approach or, we'll be able to catch up approach is fundamentally less risky. When in fact, I think what we have learned through history, but certainly learned over the last 5 or 10 years, is really the opposite is risky. That taking that wait and see approach often puts you so far behind that you can't catch up. So I think there is you have to really do the work to understand the risk of inaction. And unfortunately, that's a hard thing to quantify until well after the fact, right? Like you can say, like I'll give you an example. When I was at Sears a gazillion years ago, when we were looking at some of these off-the-mall concepts, because we were losing market share in certain categories on the mall, when we would say, well, we could build this, let's say for sake of argument, kind of Best Buy knockoff, but would have Kenmore and some of the other Sears advantages, we could create our own version of that. The question was usually, the philosophy was, well, just don't build it anywhere close to one of our stores because
right, don't cannibalize our own
or cannibalization, right? And of course, because we took that attitude, well, in many cases, we didn't pursue things very aggressively, but, then the Best Buy opened across the street from the mall and we lost all that market share. So, you have to, it's easy to say, I don't want to have that outlay of money because I might lose it all, or I don't like the diversionary cannibalization effect of disrupting ourselves. But the reality is you're going to get disrupted most likely at some point, whether you do it or not. And so I think a lot of these, whether it's an acquisition, whether it's a new format, whether it's a new service offering, a lot of times they get by at least the industry leaders, they get slow walked because they're not willing to compete with themselves, or they're not willing to have a certain expense today against a theoretical expense in the future. So I don't think it's easy to precisely model that out. But my experience, both working within organizations and as a consultant, has been there's really just a fundamental misunderstanding of risk.
You bring up a thought, or I interviewed Dan Pink in his new book, The Power of Regret, and it's a great interview on The Voice of Retail. And basically in this book, and I advise everybody pick this book up because it's such an interesting read, not unlike your book, of course, is that he classifies regrets into four categories. And one of them is a regret of boldness. And that turns out to be the biggest category. In other words, when asked, the most people's regrets fit into, I should have been bolder. I misread the downside. In other words, what could have happened, And it's really reflecting on what you're saying.
Oh, I think absolutely. I really do think, and I believe this before reading Dan's book, that but his book is beautiful and lots of richness there in a way that I hadn't thought about for sure. But I do think that the power of regret and really going through that thought process can be really, really motivating. I think it's very useful to ask yourself, well, what might we regret if we were not to make this acquisition or not to start this pilot or whatever it might be? Mm-hmm. Just try to get a sense of that. Again, it's very hard to quantify because you're talking about a theoretical future. Mm-hmm. But, I often say, if you look at the unremarkable retailers today, most of them watched the last 20 years happen to them, right? Like, talk about Macy's, right?
Yeah.
Department stores, just to go back to that, because we talked about it, but department stores have lost market share in the United States for, I think it's 21 straight years. You know, I left the moderate department store business in 2003, but I can tell you, we absolutely understood at Sears that the secular trends for the department store were terrible. And nobody had any real compelling reason to suggest they were ever going to change. Like, that ship was moving. Now, did we do enough about it? Absolutely not. But, you know, you think, and Sears's problems are a whole other thing, right? But yeah. If you look at Macy's and JCPenney in particular, and you can say this about other department stores in different countries, they took very small measures or half measures, availed us nothing, as we say in the 12-step tradition, to respond to what was going on. And it's been a slow motion car crash, really. But what were those bold steps they could have taken all along the way? And now, if you look at Macy's, if you look at JCPenney, Dillard's, many others, what is it they're doing now that is really going to move the dial? All that's happened
Wetzel's Pretzels
apparently is the answer. Exactly. But you know, you think about it, how do you let 60, 70, 80% of your profit pool disappear to the TJ Maxx's, the Kohl's, the Walmart's, the Target's of the world, and not do anything meaningful to stem the tide? And there's very fundamental reasons why those formats are more successful than the on the mall versions. It's not because they don't have the Jennifer Lopez line of athleisure or something like that. That's not, or pretzels, you know, that is not solving the fundamental relevance and remarkability problem. But again, you know, now, and the reason why I say, you know, it's the regret thing is, well, you know, it would have been really helpful for Macy's to address those issues more boldly any time during the last 20 years. And now, you know, that market share is solidified with those other players. And in an era where very good is no longer good enough, to try to win back customers that have already placed their bets with other retailers is incredibly hard in this environment, or in this, you know, this age of modern retail.
Well, for the listeners, particularly the retail operators listening, what is the prescription? What is your prescription? You know, wherever you happen to sit, you've often said, in terms of the future, the great quote, the future is already here, it's just not equally distributed. Is it that kind of, you know, hit the brakes and hit your head on the windshield kind of recognition? Like well, as you sit down with clients and say, listen, here's how I see the world and here's where I see you going and here's perhaps one element you need to improve on, what's the first step? Like, how do you move an organization towards a place that isn't just fast following or isn't just behind, that actually starts to innovate and move the business forward?
Well, there's several things, and unfortunately, it is very complex. You know, people have been studying innovation certainly more thoroughly than I have been for ages. But I would say, you know, number one, you know, what are the cultural barriers? Why is it that if you're wired to say no, if you're constantly defending the status quo, what is fundamentally behind that? And cultures are notoriously hard to change. So that's the big one that unfortunately is the most.
Of course, right?
Compensation. Yeah, compensation, different talent. You know, there's a lot of things, but it's certainly hard. That's a really hard one, you know, to move quickly. I think really understanding, and this is why I say sometimes might be good to have a psychology here, but I think, you know, so much of why, again, as individuals, as teams, as organizations, we fail to take the action we must is really rooted in what Stephen Pressfield, great author, talks about, particularly in The War of Art, which I would recommend to everybody, is the resistance. You know, it's this fear, it's this kind of primal lizard brain of being wrong, of looking stupid, of getting fired. And, you know, in many cases, those are real. I think it's, get this wrong. I think Mark Twain said, you know, I've had many horrible things happen to me in my life, some of which actually came true. You know, it's like this thoughts.
Yeah.
I think I've totally bastardized that quote, but maybe we'll get it right in the show notes. But in any event, it's, you know, it really, you know, what is it that we're afraid of that keeps us from acting? And is that fear real? And this is the chance to get into the regret thing, right? Like, what about the fear of having your business be decimated over the next 5 years because you didn't do it. So you've got to try to reframe that and get that risk perception. Fundamentally, though, I think you have to realize that innovation is a discipline. Like merchandise planning is a discipline. You know, SEO maximization or SEO is a discipline, and treat it as a real set of capabilities and a process or series of processes mm-hmm. that you have to design well. Some of that is actually having what I would call, other people use different terms, you know, an R&D budget. You know, how much budget, including, you know, dollars, checks you're going to write, but also people, are going to be devoted to whatever your innovation agenda looks like. Because if it's mm-hmm. not budgeted and people aren't responsible for it, it's not very likely to get done. But a lot of it is also just being willing to try more stuff.
Can you buy innovation? So between you and I, we'd probably come up with half a dozen examples of big retailers, whether it's Walmart or Macy's, buying small innovative retailers. I think of, you know, Walmart and basically they bought Mark Lorry's business and brought that into the organization to ostensibly inject the DNA of innovation into an organization that size. I can think of others like Macy's, who bought Rachel Shechtman's business, who also tried to do the same thing, right? Where, you know, they tried to say, well, let's bring her in as chief innovation officer. Let's buy our way some innovation. Can you think of as many examples where that might work? It feels like it worked okay at Walmart. I don't know. What do you think?
I definitely think acquisition of businesses tends to work better when it fills a broader gap. It's not just about acquiring the talent, because it's usually a lot cheaper just to hire that in than buy a business. I mean, you know, in Walmart's case with Jet, you know, they did get a lot of talent. They also got the opportunity to burn through, you know, $1 billion of cash for a couple of years until they figured that out. So, but I think overall, yeah, it's probably helped them. But I don't think there are that many examples of kind of buying your way into a cultural change, because usually the culture that you buy is fighting with the culture that you have, and you still haven't solved the underlying problem. But I think it takes a village. You got to try a lot of different things if you're really going to try to change the culture. But you know, you've got to do an analysis of, you know, kind of a gap analysis and a capability analysis of where you need to move to, and then do a build and buy sort of analysis to decide what's right for your particular organization. But I wouldn't generally say that you can, you know, just buy an innovative organization and somehow, you know, that's just going to, through osmosis, make your overall organization more fundamentally innovative.
Yeah. Well, let's end on a couple of examples. And, you know, we're not shy about naming names here, but when you think about innovation in retail or brand that you look to for case studies, or you look to for inspiration, who do you look to?
Well, this one is probably a cliche to say by now, but I think Amazon continues to be a great model of a company that culturally is really wired to say yes, try a lot of stuff, celebrates failure, you know, all the kind of fail forward, all those things that innovation consultants talk about. You know, it ends up being kind of a trite example, I suppose, at one level, because they're so huge and have so much profitability that it's easy to say, well, yeah, if you were Amazon.
It wasn't always so, though, right?
It wasn't always so. And that, I think, is the broader lesson. And there's several books out there you can read about the earlier days of Amazon and how Bezos established that. So I would still go to school on Amazon, maybe not so much the last 5 years. I may have mentioned this on a podcast before, but one of the things I, in fact, just did this Monday in my keynote is I asked the audience to take out their Fire phones and hold them up high. And of course, nobody has a Fire phone because that was seen as a massive failure. But, you know, Amazon did invest very heavily in trying to create their own smartphone. It didn't work, but they wrapped it up. They moved on, but they took some of the lessons out of that to inform their Alexa and other, you know, voice commerce and other technologies. So you can fail productively in many cases, but yeah, I would go back and maybe look at the earlier days of Amazon because so much now is just, they've got this enormous cash flow and they can, you know, they can lose $50 million and it doesn't even hit the radar screen.
And it almost doesn't impact anybody's career either. And you've talked about it in terms of compensation, but it is, you know, too many of these failures and the risk is it's career limiting. But whereas in Amazon, I think that's Amazon and others, they set up a culture where that's, you know, if you're not failing, you're not innovating, and maybe you're not the right person for us, kind of thing, right?
Yeah, it's very much baked into their culture and their leadership training and performance measurement and things like that. Another example I would give another big company though is Nike. I think Nike has really been going through a pretty radical, particularly for a company of their size and history, a pretty radical rethink and reconfiguration of their business model. I think that's been informed, you know, going back to the, because I kind of skipped over this, but I'll use it here, going back to the quote you mentioned of the future's already here, it's not evenly distributed. One of the things I take away from that quote is what's going to happen to your business is probably happening right now somewhere else in the world. Maybe happening in your in what a competitor is doing. It may be happening in what's going on with a retailer in an adjacent category. It may be happening at the other end of the world, you know. But, you know, most innovation finds, you know, customer innovation anyway, finds a home somewhere else and starts to gain traction. And in today's world, it often transfers very, very quickly. So I think that is about being a student of the business, you know, seeing how consumer habits are changing, seeing what technology is making a difference. Maybe it's making a huge difference in the car wash business or something, right? But why couldn't that, if customers love it in one way of shopping or a customer experience, why couldn't that be relevant to your business? And Nike really has taken that outside in view. They're very rooted in customer insight. They're very rooted in competitive insight, consumer trends around the world. When they started the consumer direct offense, they took their team around the globe to see customer experience innovation in many different forms in many different countries. And so some of that is that process of innovation and stimulation. But they've been willing to really rethink their business model. They've backed out of a bunch of long-term wholesale partnerships. They've invested very aggressively. I think we mentioned this a little bit in a recent episode, but you know, a lot of people think that the Nike innovation in their business model is all about going more direct. But it's also about leveraging customer data. It's about personalization, membership. You know, there's a lot of elements of what they're doing that's not just about, oh, we're going to really get good at e-commerce. And they're innovating in their business format as well, deploying a lot of different types of retail to get closer to the customers and maximize their share of wallet and share of market, whether that happens to be through a physical store that they own or distribution partner or their own .com.
I guess in the vernacular of Amazon, it's the flywheel, right? The flywheel effect. A lot of different things that eventually start to spin and create geometric gains, not arithmetic gains. And I guess I'd also like to end, because often we talk about the digitally native vertical brands. We've had the Citizenry on recently, and we talk about them in earnings. But really, there's a tremendous amount of innovation and disruption happening there, right? So how do you, you know, that probably is another pool of learnings. You may not want their business model, but certainly innovation stems from a lot of things that happen in the DNVBs. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would look, and they're kind of like the most obvious kind of category to glom onto, but I think both within retail and outside of retail, what are those companies that are really gaining market share quickly? You know, what is it that they are doing? You know, is it the product design? Is it the go-to-market strategy? Is there interesting use of technology? You know, it might be a whole host of things that they're doing, but there's something about a Warby Parker that is more than just they happen to be in the eyeglass business, right? So
right.
I particularly think, I mean, one of the more obvious examples from the digitally native vertical brands is because they started as digital only businesses. You know, they never developed the silos between the channels. They are very data driven. They put the customer really at the center and end up being pretty channel agnostic. And so there's plenty of things to be learned. Of course, as we talked about with at the top of the show about, you know, some of the earnings are not necessarily, you know, they may be doing things that are inherently not sustainable. So you got to be careful
not
to take away the wrong lesson. But when you look at so much innovation that's occurred in the consumer industry world more broadly, not just in retail, I mean, I'd go to school on that and see what can be possibly relevant to your business today, or just maybe things that you need to be watching out for the future. And maybe it's not, to your earlier point, you know, you don't necessarily have to take bold action on it right this second, but you better be on top of it and build that agility into your system so you can move when you need to move.
Well, I can't think of a better way to leave this episode with that thought, right? Which is you don't necessarily have to be on the bleeding edge or writing the edge cases, but you got to be ready to move. And you probably, as you often say, got to be ready to move faster than you think. So I think it's a great way to to wrap this episode up. A reminder once again to our listeners to leave us a question. If you've got questions about anything we were talking about, anyone we've talked to, or anything that's on your mind that that you want Steve or myself to give our opine on, leave us a message at speakpipe.com/remarkableretail, and you too may hear your voice on our podcast. If you like what you heard, please follow us on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform so you can catch up with all our great interviews and insights, and new episodes will show up each and every week. Be sure to check out our YouTube channel, and last but not least, tell your friends and colleagues in the retail industry all about us.
And I'm Steve Dennis, author of the best-selling book, Remarkable Retail, How to Win and Keep Customers in the Age of Disruption. You can learn more about me, my consulting, and keynote speaking at stephenpdennis.com.
And I'm Michael LeBlanc, producer and co-host of the Conversations of Commerce Next podcast, the voice of retail podcast, keynote speaker, and host of the all-new Last Request Barbecue Cooking Show on YouTube. And you can learn even more about me on LinkedIn or meleblanc.co. Have a safe week, everyone.